you may have read something, or maybe you heard a lecture or something. But if you bring an explanatory model to a living, breathing human, sentient being in front of you and don't listen to the being that they are projecting of themselves, then you're doing violence to that person.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 19 of Damn the Absolute. Buddhist practice has been around since the 6th century. As a way of life, Buddhism acknowledges there is suffering in the world, which arises from selfish desire, and that by letting go of this desire and following the Eightfold Path put forward by the Buddha, we can be liberated from suffering. In tandem, followers of the Buddha are called to reduce the suffering of all sentient beings. But what does this mean in the context of racism in the United States, in particular, the enormous damage inflicted upon Black Americans throughout the past 4 centuries? What insight might Buddhism offer us as we continue to pursue racial justice and greater equality? Charles Johnson is a University of Washington professor emeritus, novelist, philosopher, short story writer, cartoonist, and essayist. In addition to receiving the 1990 National Book Award for his novel, Middle Passage, he has authored 24 other books, including most recently, Grand, A Grandfather's Wisdom for a Happy Life. Throughout his expansive career, he has written extensively on Buddhism, race, creativity, martial arts, and the writer's craft. Presenting Buddhism as a radical form of liberation, Johnson suggests that to truly let go of race, we must abandon our assumptions and explanatory models of who we think other people are, and that by relinquishing our ego, we can achieve what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. calls the beloved community. A few questions to consider. How does Buddhism inform political activism? If Buddhism teaches there is nothing we should cling or attach to, what does that mean for our political commitments or philosophical worldviews? And how do we navigate the tension between letting go of race while amplifying awareness of its continuing negative impacts on people of color? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Well, Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have an initiating question we like to ask at the beginning of the show. What is a viewpoint you've held in adulthood you were confident wouldn't change that's actually shifted dramatically for you?
Well, I guess the one idea or experience that has transformed most for me has to do with my being a writer and someone who uses language as his tool. I've been publishing stories and drawings and so forth and essays and other things for 56 years now. So language is my medium. But one of the things I've come to realize, and I'm pretty sure it's through Buddhist practice, is that language can be dangerous. Language is powerful. It can create illusions. And so I'm very, very careful about how I speak. I want to present myself in such a way that I'm offering right speech, as we say in Buddhism, and careful speech. So yeah, that's changed for me a lot. My faith in the language to take us to the truth has been disabused a little bit. It's a wonderful tool, but I think we just have to understand language as being only that, a tool.
I think you'll find a welcome audience here who resonates with that notion of language as a tool. For those in the audience who are less familiar with Buddhism, what are a few key concepts that are central to understanding Buddhist practice or Buddhist thought?
Well, Buddhism is 2,600 years old. There is a tremendous amount that has been written by Buddhists and about Buddhists, sutras and commentaries on sutras across several different traditions, the Theravada tradition, the Mahayana tradition, right? But actually, Buddhism is extraordinarily simple because it is about our experience of life itself. And a central concept, at least two central concepts, would be the presence of suffering in our lives and in the world, and impermanence. Now, when I say impermanence, what I mean, quite simply, is that everything dies, ultimately, comes into being and passes away. That often, for many of us, all of us perhaps, causes suffering. You know, that feeling of loss. So this is where the Buddha Dharma begins. If someone is going to be a Buddhist, regardless of your tradition in the Buddhaverse, you know, regardless of what branch of the Bodhi tree that you practice, there are a couple of things that must be accepted. One of those things is the Four Noble Truths. They are common to all forms of Buddhism, and I'll explain what they are. The first noble truth says simply the obvious. There is suffering. That exists. The second noble truth is this. The cause of suffering is selfish desire. In Sanskrit, the word used is trishna, trishna. It means thirst or craving. The cause of suffering is selfish thirst or craving. The third noble truth is, don't despair. There is a solution to this experience of suffering and a resolution for it. And the fourth noble truth is simply this, that resolution is to be found in the Eightfold Path, which is something that we all try to practice.
You make the distinction between pain and suffering. What exactly is that?
Well, I like the way that some other Buddhists have phrased it. Candace Robb is a friend of mine, a writer, and she's phrased it this way. She was a neighbor, actually, for a while. And you'll find this in my book, Grand, A Grandparent's Wisdom for a Happy Life. It's the title of one of the chapters. Pain is something that comes in all of our lives in different forms. It could be physical pain, it could be psychological pain, it could be mental pain. But suffering is voluntary or optional. And that's worth thinking about. We all are going to experience pain, but I don't think it is necessary for all of us to experience suffering.
I wanted to touch a little bit more on impermanence, because I think impermanence is a challenging concept for a lot of us, not just psychologically, but philosophically. If it is true that everything dies, nothing exists forever, if someone is trying to build a philosophical worldview with a firm foundation, is that possible? If nothing's permanent, what does that mean for notions of eternal or absolute truths?
Well, I believe all truth, all statements that we make, all claims that we make are provisional. They are provisional and will be altered or changed based on new evidence that comes to us. Absolute truth, I don't think we even need to worry about what that is. You can build a philosophy, yes, on impermanence, and that's what Buddhism does. You know, see, one of the things that's interesting to me, I've always loved about Buddha Dharma, is that it is the only quote-unquote religion. Now, I say that in quotes because it's also a philosophy. It is the only religion that has the goal of freeing us from itself. The whole thrust of Buddha Dharma is liberation for the individual, freedom for the individual. And this is why I feel it's always been important for Black Americans, because our country's history, our greatest goal has been freedom and liberation. But sometimes we've only defined it in very small ways, very narrow ways, very immediate ways. You know, the freedom to sit down at a lunch counter, okay? That was denied Black people during the era of segregation. Well, yes, that's a certain kind of freedom. But Buddha Dharma is talking about a much greater freedom.
You're touching a little bit onto some of the political, and I know a lot of people who at least have a cursory understanding of Buddhism will look at non-attachment or these notions of acceptance that show up in Buddhism of either going with the flow or letting things flow through you. How does Buddhism relate to political activism in which one needs to be sort of humble about what one knows without grasping or clinging too absolutely to certain political principles?
Well, I would refer people who have those questions to Thich Nhat Hanh's Principles of Engaged Buddhism. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh, we became aware of him during the Vietnam War. And he did a press conference back in the 60s with Martin Luther King Jr. in regard to that war. He was nominated by King for the Nobel Peace Prize, which I think he should have received. He's one of our truly, truly great spiritual teachers, like the Dalai Lama. But to give you an example, I was talking to a friend about this just the other day. During the Vietnam War, he was very young then. Thich Nhat Hanh and his monks would go to the aid of everyone suffering, whether they were Viet Cong or whether they were in the South. If we're talking about a wounded soldier, if we're talking about a widow, if we're talking about children who have been orphaned, it does not matter what their political beliefs are. They are suffering. And if we are Buddhists and we follow what is called the way of the Bodhisattva and wish to reduce suffering for all sentient beings, then we will try to approach everyone with compassion or metta and loving kindness. Everyone. We do not see in political terms, and this was also true of Gandhi and it was true of King. You don't want to see someone who disagrees with you politically as your enemy. That is not going to bring them over to your side at all. Gandhi said of the British, listen, they have to go. You know, this colonialism has to end. But when they go, we want them to go as our friends, right? This is how we want them to leave. Similarly, with Martin Luther King Jr., the point is not to destroy your enemy, crush your enemy. This form of dualism will only lead to more violence, okay, and more suffering. What you want is for somebody to leave a space for your supposed enemy to have dignity, and hope at some point through your actions, they will come to see the wisdom of the, you know, the way that you were living, the path that you were living, and they will experience awakening. Someone who kind of did that a little bit, think about George Wallace, standing in the door as a segregationist, you know, so the kids can't go to school. But later, he begins to change. You have to hold out that possibility for the other to change. Now, if you've been a parent, you understand this very, very well. When one of your kids, you know, hits puberty, you know, they hit adolescence, they can become a little difficult for a while. They're trying to figure out who they are. And the thing is, there might be a certain day where you do not like them because of their behavior, but you will, of course, always love them. And what you have is a teleological love, by which I mean you love who you know they can become as they evolve out of the confusion that they are presently experiencing as a teenager or as a racist. You know, you hold out that possibility for the person they will become. That's teleological love.
You're speaking about political activism from a place of love and expanding the circle. What role does anger have in activism for a Buddhist? I think of there are a lot of people in United States history, especially including right now, who have good reason to be very angry and frustrated in a lot of circumstances. What role or what place does anger have in a Buddhist life when it comes to political activism?
Well, you know, I'm not a Buddhist teacher. I have friends who are true Buddhist teachers, okay? This is what they've devoted their lives to as monks and as nuns. I'm a follower of the Buddha Dharma, an Upasaka. I took my vows in the Soto Zen tradition in 2007, but I never present myself, nor will I ever do that, as a Buddhist teacher. Now, some have said I teach Buddha Dharma in my writings, and I certainly hope that's true. But for those who are full-time, you know, monks and nuns, no. They are the teachers. So let me say this about that in terms of my own personal experience. Anger is energy. Anger is a form of energy. You do not have to let it overwhelm you when you experience anger. It's very important if you practice mindfulness, and that's a very big practice today for a lot of people who are not even Buddhists because they've extracted mindfulness right mindfulness from the Eightfold Path. But if you practice mindfulness as a Buddhist or not a non-Buddhist, what you realize is that anger is an episode of mind. It too is impermanent. All thought and feeling that passes through your consciousness is impermanent. It will come, it will go. Now, if you hold on to the anger, if you nurture it, then it will increase and you will perhaps act in a way that is something you will regret later. Far better it is to recognize dispassionately the thoughts and the feelings that pass through your consciousness and choose to act upon those that will cause the least suffering in the world, okay? And those that you have a sense will cause suffering, those are the ones you let expire. You let the energy dissipate, if that makes sense. You know, you can transform that energy of anger into something positive.
In your essays, Charles, you talk about spiritual decline in the United States. When you talk about this, what comes to mind for you when you see evidences of this?
Well, I've been thinking about this for quite a long time. What comes to mind for me is the lack of civility, the way that we talk to each other in a way that tears each other down. And I see it in the violence, the really tragic violence that we seem to be having every week in one form or another, from mass shootings to all kinds of loss of life for children, even. This is a dangerous moment in American history. I truly believe that. It's an extremely important moment in American history, and I would like to see us come through it because I have a 9-year-old grandson. I would like to see his future be one in which he does not have to live in fear if he goes to a supermarket or a grocery store or a movie theater or any place where large numbers have gathered in fear for his life.
Those are observations that align with some of my own. If you were to diagnose some of the sources of this fear and anger, where do you think some of that comes from?
Where does it come from? Fear? Well, the fear and anger can probably, well, many, many reasons, I guess. Some are sociological, some are political, some are economic, and those are real reasons. But at the base of it, the fear is the fear of the ego about its own extinction, the fear of death for the ego or suffering by the ego. And one of the things that we constantly work on as Buddhists is our ego. They're trying to take our ego out of our actions and dealings with others. Yeah, I think a lot of people right now are scarred and scared. A lot are wondering about their own survival and health and well-being.
You've touched on the legacy of Dr. King already, and I'd like to lean a little bit more heavily into that. The beloved community is a term that's pretty inseparable from his legacy. And it's something that's come up in a lot of your work, including your book, Dreamer, which is a novel pertaining to some of his life. What does the beloved community mean to you?
Well, in my first published article in Tricycle, this was many, many years ago, the editor gave the article the title, A Sangha by Another Name, A Sangha. Sangha is the Buddhist community, the community of Buddhists who support each other. We have three things in which we take refuge. One is the Buddha. The other is the Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha. And the third is the Sangha, or the community of Buddhists. That's literally what it meant in the beginning. However, I have other friends and I have Buddhists I've read and teachers who would say that the Sangha is much larger than just the community of monks and nuns. It is ultimately all sentient beings, right? That is the beloved community.
Reverend King's legacy has been pretty airbrushed, watered down because he's been canonized. A lot of the more challenging, and I bring up challenge in the sense of uncomfortable for some people to understand or wrestle with, but he's been watered down. What are some of the aspects of his legacy you would like to highlight, some of the complexities and some of the things that you think are lost on a lot of us?
Well, that's the reason that I wrote my novel, Dreamer, which came out quite a few years ago, 1998. But I spent 7 years working on that novel, researching it. I mean, I did everything a writer is supposed to do. I went to his birth house and took a tour through it. I went to the Lorraine Motel to examine the room that he was in the night before he was assassinated. I read everything I could about the man, his speeches, his sermons, the papers of Martin Luther King. There were three volumes out at that time. I immersed myself in King because I realized after working on my other novel, Middle Passage, that we invoke his name often. But who was this man? I realized I didn't have a sense of fullness in my understanding about him. Now, I was in my senior year of high school, 1966, when King came to Chicago, and that was his only Northern campaign. I remember his presence in Chicago, because I grew up in Evanston, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. I remember his presence there in early January, right? So he's always been there in some sense in my life, one way or another. However, what Malcolm X's daughter said of her father is also true of Martin Luther King Jr. She said, people take pieces of him. They take selectively the pieces that they want to hold up and say, oh, well, King said this. Well, they don't look at the fullness of the whole man. So for me as a novelist, I had to look at everything. I had to ask questions about everything. I mean, what was his favorite music? What kind of cigarettes did he smoke? All the questions that you would deal with creating a fictional character. And that was very illuminating for me. I try to share with the reader some of my conclusions about King in the novel Dreamer. One of the things that we have to try to remember, I guess it's important, is that he was a philosopher. He was a trained theologian. And so there's a great deal of sophistication in his thinking about not just civil rights issues, but larger issues of how shall we live. I knew back in the 80s, he must have said some things about that because I seem to remember them. But nobody talks about those things. Only the political king is what we talk about. Well, he had much, much to say in terms of his vision of what the beloved community should be and how each and every one of us can contribute to that community.
Dr. King's quotes you'll see on posters in people's homes or schools, and there, a lot of them are stripped of a lot of their context and some of the, as you mentioned, like some of the more challenging aspects that may make a lot of us uncomfortable of us falling short in ways of achieving the beloved community. He's a very radical social thinker as well as a philosopher. What is one of his more radical social teachings that you think is really lost on a lot of us?
Well, I think Congressman John Lewis said it very well. He was one of the last surviving members of the civil rights movement and passed away recently. But I always like this quote that he offered to us. And the quote is this: nonviolence was never supposed to be just a tactic or a strategy during civil rights demonstrations. Nonviolence was intended to be a way of life. That was King's understanding as well. And it's also the Buddhist understanding. My friend with whom I took my vows, Vietnam veteran Kwan Dam Chin Thomas, who is a mendicant monk, he puts it this way. We can do a lot of things to make the world a better place, and we should do those things. But when it comes down, he also believes as a Vietnam vet, that we can end wars. We need to be able to do that, but we're not going to be able to do that, achieve peace, until we become peace ourselves. We have to start with ourselves on a daily basis, on a moment-by-moment basis, if we want to achieve peace or nonviolence or love.
There's a quote from Kwan Dam Chin Thomas you mentioned that I really resonated with. It says, I cannot think myself into a new way of living. I have to live myself into a new way of thinking. What does he mean by that exactly?
It's a beautiful quote. You cannot think yourself into a new way. No, this is one of the things one realizes, I guess, in Buddhist practice and meditation. Awakening is not going to come to any of us through through discursive reasoning. It's not going to happen that way. It's larger and deeper than our concepts. Larger and deeper than our thought. It has to be experience. And what that means is that even though when you start your Buddhist practice, you may have questions, right? You may have a million questions when you start as a Buddhist. Am I doing this right? Am I doing that right? But what happens if you stick with it? It is through the experience of daily practice and meditation and following the precepts that sooner or later, those questions dissolve or fade away. They are no longer questions for you, not in terms of your experience. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm tempted here to bring up a quote, which I've brought up before on the show, and it's from John Dewey, but I think it fits very closely to what you're expressing. John Dewey once mentioned, a lot of our philosophical problems we don't solve, we just get over. And I think we just sort of let go of them because they're no longer meaningful, or we realize they're problems that are more mental that we've just created for ourselves.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. And what Dewey is saying is not terribly different from what Wittgenstein wanted to make a point of too. A lot of our philosophical problems, but also other problems we have created for ourselves, first of all, and upon close examination, they will dissolve. They will fade away because they're not really problems. Yeah, Dewey's real good. The pragmatists are pretty good at that.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Digging a little bit into some other philosophies here, in Buddhism, the sense of the self is an illusion. There's not an essential self. And I'm wondering, what connection do you see between this Buddhist notion of no self with the anti-essentialism that you find in existential thought or in American pragmatism?
Well, that's a very good question. And I'm glad you ask it because people always ask this question. There's a phrase, it's a Pali phrase that I think about all the time. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Anicca means that things are impermanent. They die. Dukkha means there's suffering. Anatta means there is no self. There is no self. But now we have to be very careful about this. If you look at the sutras, you see that the Buddha refers to his disciples by name. You know, there is Ananda, you know, over there. There is this disciple over there. This is conventional speech, obviously, right? You have a history, I have a history, and so forth. Because the Buddha said this, I am teaching you the doctrine of no self, but if you become attached to it, I will teach a doctrine of self, because the whole purpose is not to become attached. So in terms of conventional reality as opposed to absolute reality, samvritti satya as opposed to paramartha satya, yes, you are an individual, you have a history. There's nobody who's ever lived like you before or will live be like you ever again. But when we really begin to examine things, what we realize is that what we call the self is a construct. It is a social construct. It is not permanent. It is not an essence by any means whatsoever. The way I often like to put this is, we are not nouns, we are verbs. We are not being, we are becoming, if that makes sense. Alfred North Whitehead, the wonderful philosopher, put it this way: we have to be careful of the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. And we do that often with the self, the I, the me, the my, you know, myself. But no, we are processes. We are not products. Nouns, verbs are not nouns.
Yeah, it's also, and this is also attributed to Whitehead, the notion of we often mistake the map for the territory.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
Or similar in Buddhist tradition of mistaking the finger pointing at the sun for the sun.
Or the moon, yeah.
Or the moon, yes. Excuse
me. No, that sounds exactly right to me.
Naturally, you've written a lot on race and Buddhism. What do you find particularly appealing, or what do you think is particularly appealing about Buddhism for Black Americans?
Well, again, you know, to state what I said before, if there is a eidos or essence, if you like, of Black American history, from slavery through segregation to the present moment, it is the desire for freedom. And I really do think that the Buddha Dharma offers that in the most radical way possible. Buddhism is one of the most radical ways of looking at the world, because you're looking first at the source of your experience of the world, which is your own consciousness, your own mind. That is where your experience of the world begins. And so, do you understand your own mind, its operations, how consciousness, performs in moment by moment in your existence, how your perception takes place? This is very radical, okay? More radical than anything that I've ever seen in terms of political philosophy.
When you are speaking to others in the Black community or any Black community or other communities of color about Buddhism as a radical form of liberation, I'm sure there are some in the group who push back. What are some of the criticisms that some people do have when they push back against this idea of Buddhism as a meaningful form of liberation?
Well, again, I'm not a Buddhist teacher. I'm a writer who happens to be practicing Buddhist. Now, I have friends like Lama Choyen Rangdrol, who is a Buddhist teacher and talks to groups of Black Americans all the time about what might be beneficial if they were to begin, Buddhist practice. I think my friend Jan Willis, also, who is a Tibetan Buddhist icon, one of the first Black Americans to embrace, the Tibetan Buddhist path. I'm sure she has encountered this as well. I think the pushback that you may get most from anybody, not just Black Americans, but anybody, might possibly come from Christians. It might come from people who have a Christian point of view. Now, I was a cradle Christian. I was, born into the African Methodist Episcopal Church. So I grew up with that. But I do think for Christians who do think very dualistically, them versus us, sin versus salvation, heaven versus hell, Buddhism might be a little bit frightening. But again, Jan Willis has a wonderful way to put this. She says, because she's a Baptist Buddhist, she says, my Buddhist practice helps me to realize my Baptist ideals. Mm. And she's right about that.
Your essay, Every 28 Hours, is a profound essay. And that's a reference to just the tragic reality that every 28 hours, a Black person is either killed by the state or state-sanctioned violence. And in this essay, you're writing about the case of Trayvon Martin. The names of so many other people could be included here.
Yes.
And it's been a year since George Floyd was killed. What insight does Buddhism offer us in this moment as many continue to fight for racial justice?
I think, again, we have to look within. Trayvon was killed by George Zimmerman, right?
Mm-hmm.
You listen to what he said to the police, about Black people as he's watching Trayvon. He says they always get away with something, blah, blah, blah. In my essay, one of the things I tried to point out is George Zimmerman had killed Trayvon and other Black people thousands of times in his mind before he ran into Trayvon. He has done violence to them in his imagination, right? In his intellect. And so he was conditioned by himself and maybe by racist aspects of our society to act in the way that he did. We always have to go back again to our thoughts. Yeah. I think he killed many times in his mind through anger and maybe even hatred before he actually pulled the trigger.
You talk about, from a very Buddhist perspective, of letting go of race. And I want to unpack that, but I also have a second question with that is, what does it mean to let go of race in the context of many other social or political activists who want to magnify race as a way of bringing about greater equality? There feels like there's a tension there of letting go of race while at the same time drawing proper attention to it in order to address inequalities.
Well, I think that's a very good question, a very important question. Well, there's a couple of ways I would maybe want to come at it. One of the things that's really a controversial and hot topic right now is critical race theory. And I have friends who are involved in critical race theory, like philosopher George Yancey, in which we are being asked to think all the time about race and how it has affected our lives, even unconsciously. Now, I think there's a truth in that because of the nature of what happened from Reconstruction all the way through the era of segregation. Many white Americans are totally unaware of the privilege that they experience in the communities that they live in. 80% of white Americans live in all white communities, for example. So there is some value to be gained by looking at the history of race, all right? Because it does have a history. And we could even trace it back a couple of centuries ago to see the formation of racist theories or race as a theory, right? But my position is simply that race is a lived illusion. It is a lived illusion that has caused enormous suffering all around the world. How do you let that go? I know how you let that go. Stop thinking about people in terms of your ideas about them. You see an individual, stop, listen, deeply listen to that person, who they are, what they, you know, in terms of what they're saying. They will express themselves to you right here, right now, okay, in the present moment, and you will gain understanding of who this person is without your presuppositions, prejudices, and preconceived ideas or explanatory models for what you think this human being is. You have to give up your presuppositions. You see what I'm saying? Your prejudices, and just listen with epistemological humility to the other right there in front of you.
When it comes to discussions around race, there are some who want to advocate for a more sort of colorblind approach to some of these questions, or even maybe that's ignoring race is how some critics of that view would say, but taking either a colorblind approach versus some who want to, in a more critical race tradition, would alternatively want to highlight that to increase the awareness of the advantages white Americans or other racial groups have had over others. What are your stances or views on this more colorblind approach that has, I know, been around at least for a few decades, pretty predominant?
Yeah, it's been around for a while. It's been abused, that term, colorblind. It certainly, I guess, was well-meaning maybe back in the 60s. You know, there would be white people who would say, oh, I don't see race, you know. But that's not true. Of course you do. You see if this person is somehow different from you in a surface cosmetic way. Then, you know, perhaps different complexion, you know, perhaps different features, whatever that might be. You're not blind. No, you're obviously seeing that. But what the danger is making assumptions on the basis of that about another individual. That is a way of doing violence to them. You may have read something, or maybe you heard a lecture or something, but if you bring an explanatory model to a living, breathing human, sentient being in front of you and don't listen to the being that they are projecting of themselves, then you're doing violence to that person. So the best thing is humility. Don't make assumptions. As one of my friends likes to say, if you make assumptions, you make an ass, A-S-S, out of you, and me. Any assumptions about others, you're on dangerous ground, and particularly any oversimplifications about other people. That is a very dangerous and logically fallacious path to tread.
This raises a lot of difficult questions. I don't think we're going to solve all of these today, but I think you offer some really clarifying thinking that I appreciate. Charles, what are you working on right now? What are you writing? What's the next thing?
Well, I'm kind of up to
you're always writing work. Many things, and you're always producing something creatively.
Well, it's because I love to create. I love, you know, creativity is about discovery. It's about two things for me. It's about discovering something I've not known before, and it's about problem solving a problem. Now, at the moment, I find myself with wall-to-wall work because three books have come out that I have some association with. One is called It's Life as I See It. It's right over there in the corner. Black Cartoonists in Chicago, 1940 to 1980. And I'm one of those cartoonists who grew up in Chicago and spent a large part of my life working as an illustrator. There's a show associated with the book, It's Life as I See It. It opens on the 16th in Chicago at the Museum of Contemporary Art. That's one project I'm involved with. Another project is the Chicago Quarterly Review's latest issue, issue number 33, which is an anthology of work by other Black American writers. I served as guest editor for this issue, and we started working last summer on it. But we have some fine writing by award-winning, well-known, and emerging Black poets, artists, essayists, storytellers, and so forth. So we're setting up right now bookstore Zoom visits for the writers to read their work late this month, August, and into September. Now, the other third thing that I have to do some promotion for is the second novel of the great novelist Ralph Ellison called Juneteenth. And it is out now, a new edition. In 1999, when the first edition came out, I wrote a preface. But for the new edition, I wrote a more expanded preface that is there in the front of the book, which was basically given to us by the great Ellison scholar, John Callahan. He took Ellison, this is posthumous. Ellison died before he could finish the book. And Callahan and a couple of other scholars made sure they went through thousands of pages of his notes and drafts to construct the book that they think he would have given us. So those are things I'm working on at the moment.
Well, I look forward to reading some of those. I appreciate you coming on the show, sharing so much of your wisdom with us, and good luck with all your future projects.
You're very kind. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. All blessings to you.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.